140 characters in a tweet. Why can't you count our votes? Every million vote lead should have been your defeat. Why can't you count our votes? We're not done. We're not tired. We won't stop until Donald Trump,
you're fired!
She said people who earn talking head status. Our next speaker is somebody who has definitely earned talking head status. He is, you name it, he's done it. He's an economist, a historian. He worked for both the House and the Senate. We won't hold it against you.
Yep.
He worked for the State Department. We won't hold it against you. Professor, and I think most important of all, he inspires us to think that there is something beyond capitalism, and
thank
it's
you.
Something much better than what we have now. He is the guru of the next system. He is the chairperson of what's called the next system. And he is a prolific writer.
Yep.
If you haven't read his books, you should. And if you want to read one for free, I'm sorry, can I advertise the free one?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, because he's not really a capitalist, right? So the free one is you can go to www.thenextsystem.org/principles, and it's called Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth.
Yep.
So let's give a big hand to the talking head status, Gar Alperin.
That's the first time I've been called that.
Thank you.
What I really want to say first is that I'm from Wisconsin, and I want to say one thing about Wisconsin, too. First, it feels great to be back in the Midwest. That's number one. But I can remember way back, vaguely, I'm older than I look, in the late 1950s, Joe McCarthy was still around. And everyone in the country was scared stiff. Can't do anything. But in Wisconsin, it was double, triple scared stiff. People were really shaking. They shot anything that moved. And McCarthy was everywhere. And so if you had said at that time, we can build a movement that's going to be powerful, somehow we're going to overcome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is the 50s. They looked at you kind of, are you crazy? Look at what's happening all over here. Nothing's happening. And then the 60s exploded right out from under them. So I come to where we now are as a historian, mainly. And from those old days, those of you guys who know Gaylord Nelson, I was his legislative director, the guy who started the great environmentalist, the Earth Day. So that's for my sins, I was there. And I was also there when we tried to stop the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and failed. And we put in that legislation to try to do that. But that's a long time ago, and I've been much more involved in movement building and economics and how we change the system going forward. So let me talk a little bit about that and why I think that this era and people like the people in this room and people who are going to be at this conference, which really is beautifully organized in terms of this. Congratulations to the folks who put it together. I think that we have the chance, I'm going to say it carefully, of establishing the conditions of a fundamental systemic transformation. I didn't say we're going to get there tomorrow. I said that if we put it together and are serious, we can build the basis of an irreversible transformation to the next system. And that's where I think we are. And I think that is critically important and possible. So that's kind of the opening line. The second thing I want to say about kind of thinking back to those old days, for my sins, I wrote a book a long time ago on the bombing of Hiroshima. It was a doctorate, it was a PhD thesis. And it came out and it was published by a big publisher. And then the front page of the New York Times, front page of the Washington Post, both reviewed it and attacked the hell out of it. Because I said what we now know to be true, that the bombing was totally unnecessary and known at the time to be totally unnecessary. Every major military figure of the time, including President Eisenhower, came out publicly after the bombing saying it was totally unnecessary and totally immoral. But the system carried forward in many ways to make that happen. There's a sidebar to it because it's a nasty system. I'm not a utopian. After the bombing of Hiroshima and the bombing of Nagasaki, and after the Japanese had gone public with their surrender, public, but the papers hadn't yet passed, Truman ordered the largest bombing, conventional bombing raid in world history, 1,400 bombers, just to make sure and show what happened. So I have no illusions about the nature of the system. And my experiences in the House and Senate, and 1 year in working on UN matters in the State Department, trying to do something on Vietnam, have left me with no illusions. And yet I want to say to you, I think we are at a period, and we've, lots of folks have said this in the past, historically, that we're going to change the system. And it's possible, and it's coming, better days tomorrow. I think, and I say it cautiously and carefully, and I'll try to explain why, I think we are in the prehistory of actually laying down the foundations of a fundamental transformation. And I think we're going to win. That's going to take a lot of work and a lot of pain and a lot of danger and a lot of movement building with the kind of work that's gone into this conference. But let me tell you why I think it's important and why I think conferences like this and what we do for the next 4 days is really important. In many ways, if you think about, and let me say by way of kind of introduction to this, my heroes in all of this kind of work are the civil rights workers in Mississippi in the 1930s and 40s. They laid down the irreversible patterns and moral basis and beginning organizing, which made the basis of what became the civil rights movement possible. They did it when the dangers were much greater, when they would not only fight you and beat you, but hang you after having fought you and beat you. But they laid down something, and I think that's in some ways where we are, establishing the foundations of the great transformation. And I think they've run out of gas. So I think we shall win after great danger, or we have a damn good chance of doing it. So let me open that up to you a little bit, partly as a political economist and partly just my own experience and judgments on what's happening. In one way or another, you're talking about, you want to play this game, you're talking about laying down decades of your life, not weeks, and everyone in the room knows that. But if you look at another way about it, the patterns of the political economic system and the expansion of the system into imposing different ways of power on different parts of the world in some ways are declining as a basis of managing the system. Now what does that mean? Let me put it this way. For the longest period after World War II and up till now, they have been managing American capitalism badly, largely with military expenditures. They've stabilized the economy that way. They have not had the capacity to run the system irrespective of military expenditures. They don't know how to do it, and they don't have the power to do it. So you get massive unemployment, then you get discontent, then you get protests, then you get democratic elections, and so forth. but they have been running it on the hopes that they could do it via policy. Now, we spend a lot of money on military expenditures to run the military and the imperial system, no doubt about that. But if you stand back from that perspective, it has gone from, in the post-war period, 14% of the economy was military in World War in the Korean War. It went down to about 7% during the Korean, 7 and 8% during the Vietnam War. It has gone steadily down, very large, absolutely, but as a percentage of the economy, it is 3.3% now, and declining. Huge amounts of expenditure, terrible waste, very large economy, very large military, but not adequate to manage the economy and keep full employment going and keeping discontent going and keeping the anger down that's building up all over the country. So they are losing the capacity on military spending and violence to managing the economy, which means one way or another, discontent and upset and anger at the political system as well as the economic system is growing. So I think that's the larger context into which we are working. At the same time, and then we'll go into the dangers of the period, at the same time, there is a whole bubbling up of what can only be called the beginnings of a serious, first time in my life, and I think first time in the modern era since the 1920s, of what begins to look like the foundational work on the ground, community by community by community, building up elements of what begins to look like a different system. Now, I'm pretty cautious about that. I'm a kind of skeptical historian and political economist. But one of the challenges that we need to face if we're going to change the system, and I suspect there's a few people in this room who are thinking about that, if you don't like corporate capitalism, and you don't like state socialism, and the liberal position of allowing the corporations to run the game as long as we can run welfare programs and social programs around is dying before your eyes, what is it you want? What is the nature of the next system? What does it look like? And one of the exciting things that's happened, and the first time I've ever seen it, and the first time in my lifetime, but I also haven't seen it historically, there's an explosion of people engaging that in practical ways and in theoretical ways, and in ways that are covered very rarely by the media, but if you look, we keep track of it at the Next System Project, there is an enormous amount going on in democratizing and changing the ownership of the system, working from the bottom up. Systems are about, primarily, who gets to own the capital, who gets to own the wealth, and how do you run it? And in state socialism, the state ran it, in corporate capitalism, the corporations run it, and if we build and plan to change the system, I suspect there are people who want to change the system. That's the name of the game. Then you need to begin to ask, what is it you want? And how do we begin to articulate what we want? And then how do we build it and show and build up the models that look forward? What's exciting about this period of time and what I think is happening with building itself into a movement, we are seeing this happening all over the country. There are, for instance, all over the country, worker co-ops for the first time in modern history are beginning to be built in many, many, many communities. Now, what's important about a worker co-op? Not just that it's a co-op, but it changes who owns capital in a small way and who owns wealth. It's not capitalism, it's not state socialism, but begins to give you a suggestion of a different way to democratize wealth ownership without building a gigantic Stalinist state. That's a critical one. What else? We're beginning to see land trusts pop up in many parts of the country to deal with land gentrification and land inflation. Now, what is a land trust? Draw a circle around a neighborhood or a community, set up a nonprofit, or have a public ownership, and change the ownership of the land in order to control the inflation that's pushing people out and away. Decentralized, democratic ownership of the means of land in this case. We're seeing another kind of thing. We're seeing, for instance, in Boulder, Colorado, they just took over the private utility and made them to a public utility.
Yeah. Sweet. Yeah.
And you guys in Minneapolis tried, maybe you'll try again as well.
Oh, yeah.
And win. They just won. And what is that? That's a citywide ownership of wealth. Taking over, in this case, because people are trying to deal with climate change. Change how the system is run there. That's another piece of the one. Another piece of it that's really interesting, what's happening in many, 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 many towns now, is public banking. You guys are from North Dakota, know about public banking. It's the oldest public bank, the only public bank in the United States is the State Bank of North Dakota. It was built by populists and radicals and socialists 100 years ago, and it's right there, as lasts as a model. It is now a model inspiring people all over the country. I happened to be given a talk of this kind at the public banking conference. It was the first public banking conference about 8 years ago. And people were kind of starry-eyed about what they hoped to do, and wouldn't it be nice if we could, and wouldn't it be great if someday we could begin setting up community-owned banks. And, you know, but kind of maybe not. How can you actually do that? How do we actually change the banking system? Well, it's happening now. Here's the number. I've got a list just from the Public Banking Institute. There are 20 or 30 cities now in the process of trying to set up public banks in the country. Philadelphia is on the line, Washington, D.C., Santa Fe, Denver, Los Angeles, Oakland. City banks using city money rather than for pipelines, putting money into the city and building community co-ops and land trusts. Starting at the bottom and building up a complex of the next system, starting at the ground up, and only going to the next level if absolutely necessary. And that's happening. In some cities, some of you know about what's happening in Cleveland. The Evergreen model. Anybody know about the Evergreen model?
Yeah.
Okay, the Evergreen model is a neighborhood-wide ownership structure, nonprofit corporation, to which are attached worker-owned companies. So it's a complex, the goal of which is to build the neighborhood, not just to make a bunch of workers in different firms wealthy. And by the way, you've got to be careful of that. I mean, if you're interested in equality, you could have a worker-owned company for the oil industry and a worker-owned company for the garbage industry. You're not going to have a very equal system. So questions about the community as a whole become very important. And in Cleveland, the Evergreen model it's called, you've got a community-wide nonprofit corporation and the kickback to the center so you can set up more worker-owned enterprises, all part of a complex. And they're not little. One of the largest industrial and greenest laundries in the country is one of these co-ops. Another one's a solar installation company. Another one is a greenhouse capable of producing the 3 million heads of lettuce a year. These are not just tiny fragments moving to the next stage. And another part of that model that I particularly think interesting, and you can do it in any city, and many cities are doing it, we could talk about models that are going on in Rochester, New York, and Atlanta, and in Virginia, in Arlington, Virginia. Richmond, Virginia. There's several cities trying to replicate something like this. What's interesting is then get the universities and hospitals, nonprofit corporations, most of them, which have a lot of public money in them, Medicare, Medicaid, education money, et cetera, and they buy a lot of stuff. So they are beginning to force these big institutions that can't get up and go to buy from the complex and stabilize this community cooperative structure, and you get a stability structure building in a whole different level of thinking. Now, if you want to think about that, that's a democratic, it's a skeleton of a democratic planning system. That is to say, purchasing in order to stabilize the community and the workers' companies by using public money. If you did it on a national level, which we will do one day, then you'd have national mass transit decisions, spending money, and who makes them? In which community? The worker community-owned company in this community, but the national government, which then begins to put money down in order to stabilize communities and change the ownership of who gets to own it, worker communities. It's the same model of a planning system rather than the market. So it begins to open up that dimension. So those are some of the kinds of things we're beginning to see all over the country, and many, many, many more. If you go to the website, www.community-wealth.org, you can get a picture of what's happening. The press doesn't cover this, but it is exploding all over the country. Now, I'm a historian and a political economist, so I'm very skeptical. But this is the first time in my life that we've seen a mass developmental process where people are beginning to sketch out in real world, along with the politics of it and the challenging hard work to make things happen, elements that are suggestive of a different system. Important, it's really, really important because we're getting on the table real stuff, not just theory and not just rhetoric, about a decentralized, democratically owned system, building from the bottom up and building in different communities with different organizing strategies attached to different ways of doing this. And it begins to suggest the ways in which we might imagine and begin the debate on what the system looks like. And the question becomes, now it's not an abstract question, it's a question for every person, like the person sitting in your seat or mine. If you don't like corporate capitalism, and you don't like state socialism, what do you want? And we're beginning to flesh that out in dialogue and in practice and on-the-ground experiments all over the country. And partly what's driving it is the pain level of the system. That is to say, the pain gets worse, and there are no answers, and you either roll up your sleeves, as in all movement building, and begin doing it here, now, and with a view to generating an idea and generating a vision that can be built elsewhere around the country, too. So that part of the movement is just beginning to see itself as a political movement, as well as a building concrete, practical nuts and bolts movement. I worked with the steelworkers in 1976 in Youngstown, Ohio. Some of the folks, the older folks, might remember the biggest closing of a steel mill in the country was the Youngstown Sheet and Tube. 5,000 people lost their jobs. In 1976, that was big news. Not news anymore, because it happens all the time. It was front page news all over the country. And the steelworkers and the religious community got together and said, we're going to set up a community-worker-owned company. And it became big news, and they got organizing done. They even forced the Carter administration to give the money, I think $200,000, that would probably be the equivalent of a couple million now, to do a very sophisticated study of how to do it. They built up the religious community support, the civil rights support. It was building up, and it got to the level, and this is very interesting, got to the level about to happen in the Carter administration because the corporations, and at that point, the International Union killed it. The International Union didn't want those activists from the bottom up, kind of challenging everything, but it was the corporations who killed it. But now if you look at what's happening in the Steel Workers Union, they are now radically changed and are trying to set up these kind of worker-owned companies around the country as well. So there's an evolution that's going on even within those institutions, because there's been a change of ideology, a change of vision. So what I want to suggest to you, that there's a beginning, more than a beginning, movement on the ground, both of thinking about actually how do we change the system, not rhetorically, and actually experimenting and developing pieces on the ground. The other piece of it, a couple larger pieces of it as well. You may recall, some of your younger folks in this audience, that we nationalized General Motors, and we nationalized Chrysler, and we nationalized AIG about 10 years ago in the big crisis, and we de facto nationalized several national scale banks. We didn't call it that, but in fact they were taken over and bailed out. So that process actually happened. Now we didn't have enough power then to actually make that last and turn it into worker community owned developments, but we begin to see when the crises hit, we are going to see more of that. That's not the last time we're going to see that kind of process at the big national level. So things I think are going to move in that direction, and I'll talk a little bit more about why I think the context is opening up for a much larger movement that both integrates the anti-war movement and organizing in various communities to build towards systemic change as well as piece by piece change. And what I really love about this set of conferences, is that we're going across the board in many different areas trying to bring together the various pieces of this in one form or another that take us to that level. I suspect that the idea of changing the system is an idea that many people in this room accept and have been working on for long periods of their life and want to move that forward. I think that actually we are beginning to see that as opposed to what I call projectism. We've got a nice project here and there, wouldn't it be great? But not taking it to politics and to system change design and thinking it through as if it really mattered. Let me say something about that. I think people who work on these things, particularly on the economic side of it, although not on the civil rights side and not on the peace side, sometimes and not on the environmental side, actually don't believe what they're saying. And I suspect there are some of us who have doubts about what we believe about what we're saying. Are you saying that we can change the most powerful corporate capitalist system in the history of the world?
Yep.
Really? And I am suggesting to you that we are on the beginning phase of a major movement that is not just about the various issues that we all care about, but we are beginning, not rhetorically, to open up what can we do that actually is practical, building step by step around the country and taking advantages of the next big movement, big crashes, to big put the pieces together slowly but steadily that begin to build the fragments and skeleton of the next system. I say that as a cold-eyed economist and political historian. I think times have changed in a way that makes that a real question, not a rhetorical question, and not a romantic question, and a question that, if so, it puts a very different level of responsibility right on our laps. There's organizing and then really beginning to say, this is what it's about, and learning and teaching and getting on with that level of discussion. So I want to encourage you about that as well. And I want to kind of set the stage for it in a little different way. I think the system is in severe difficulty. So, you know, I live in Washington. We take Trump very seriously. But, you know, presidents come and go. The system remains. And so the question is, how do you change the system as well as oppose the presidents and the politics of this guy? I think they are losing the capacity to manage the system, and I want to give two ways of thinking about that. They really have used military expenditures and war as a way, not purposely, not for this purpose. There's a whole imperial structure that goes forward no matter what. But it has served to stabilize the system from the 14% at the time of the Korean War of the economy militarized to 6 to 8% during the Vietnam War. And it's only 3.3 and going down. So the most important lever they have to stabilize the system is their inability to actually generate the kind of stabilizers that they've had in the past. And I think that will continue because we're in marginal range. They may increase it to 4, down to 3, up to 4. But what they want to spend is huge amounts of money, but it's a very big economy, and it doesn't solve the problems. As we learned in this last election, massive unemployment, discontent, which they exploited the last time, but not necessarily if they don't solve the problem, and I don't think they will. There's going to be more and more openings in different communities that we haven't addressed yet. So I think that's a major, major way in which to begin to think about where we are going in all of this. Now, a larger way, this is kind of my historical frame, one way to think about it, and why I think this is the most important period of American history, bar none. I think it's potentially more important than the Revolution and the Civil War. Yeah, look at you. What's this guy talking about? If you're talking about changing the system, you are actually talking about the most important period of American history. But I want to put it in a different frame. Why it gives me, I have no illusions about the dangers of the coming period. I'm going to say a few words about that too. But if you look at the way they ran the system in the 19th century, every time they got in trouble, this little group of 4 million people maximum spread out thinly on the eastern seaboard, the little colonies, they actually took over more and more land, taking it from the natives there, killing people. They moved west when they had trouble and kept going west and taking and conquering and killing on the way until they ran out of land. That's the way they ran the system when they got in trouble. Now, that's obviously overly simplified, but it's the most important fundamental mechanism. And in the 20th century, in the first quarter of the century, the economy was in great difficulty. It was failing and declining, recessions, financial bubbles, and World War I bailed the system out in the first quarter of the century. Now, they didn't do World War I for that reason. They got lucky. But they did, in fact, do that, the system. In the second quarter of the 20th century, the Depression returned in 1937. Roosevelt was in great trouble. There was a recession within the Depression. And World War II bailed it out in the second quarter of the century. In the third quarter of the century, Korea, Vietnam, military spending, Korean was at 14% of the GDP, military spending. It was almost 8% during the highest point of the Vietnam War. That stabilized the system plus the fact that the other industrial powers had been defeated and we had a free run in international trade for a while because of World War II's destruction. In the fourth quarter of the century, they began to lose capacity, and the percentage of the economy that they can run by military spending is now down to 3.3 and declining. Huge numbers. But war isn't doing the job, and moreover, they're in trouble about wars. People don't like them, they're getting more and more angry, beginning to fight the battle and fighting more and more against the war. And pushing against that has many, many reasons, moral, political, but also declining. In that context of growing pain, of important decay, and people feeling the pain, we're beginning to get new movements, including what Bernie showed was possible, reaching out, and other activist movements moving into a context where they do not have the capacity to answer the system's problems. And that means the responsibility for moving forward on all these levels. And beginning, I am talking to the person in your seat and mine, to take seriously not only that we build a movement, which we can, not only that we can change piece by piece what needs to be changed, which we can, but that we can change the system. Now, I'm saying it in this funny way, because I don't think we think that way, really. I don't think we have yet come, most of us, to the conclusion that what we're actually about is changing the system. What are you talking about? The largest corporate capitalist imperialist system in the world? Yes, that's the name of the game. And I think we are establishing the groundwork piece by piece with conferences like this, with organizing sector after sector, with more developments of experiments, with theory, vision, as they lose capacity. Now, we may go through even worse periods politically. Chile survived Pinochet. The question does not go away, no matter what happens. And I think the period of work that we're doing, and including the younger and the older folks showing, hanging in, what I think about older folks, some of us older folks, but I see a few gray hairs in the audience, hanging in, like those people in Mississippi in the 1930s, through this longer period, is the name of the game at all fronts, and beginning to actually take seriously that who we are about is transforming this whole system in a way that does not produce the Hiroshimas, does not produce the Mississippi killings, does not destroy the climate, is open to a whole different culture, all different sexual preferences, a different vision. I think that the building of that vision, plus the economics that go with it, without which we haven't got a chance of holding on more than a moment, I think that's what this is about. And I think these conferences you folks have organized are spectacular, and I want to congratulate the organizers, and thank you for letting me be part of it. Thank you.
That's without looking at a note. That's what talking head status means, that you can speak beautifully, eloquently, brilliantly, and it's all coming from the heart.